Welcome to the program. I'm Michelle Miao.
And I'm John Zipperer.
Oh, we had a great show, John. I really love and enjoy talking to you. I always learn so much.
Well, same here. I learned from you. I learned from the guests. And today we got to go in deep on some things. Vladimir Putin and Supreme Court and our great talk with Brody Levesque.
Yeah, well, you do your own show, the week-to-week political roundtable talk, so you get the chance to talk to a lot of different people, especially what's happening in the political world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's about the personal experiences and kind of tying that back into those political conversations and applying that. I love that we're able to do that on the Michelle Miao show. And it's also very refreshing to be able to be honest and authentic with each other without, you know, screaming, even if we might disagree or and that's the whole point. And I have to remember that you are a wonderful guest to have on the show, and you used to come on the show as a guest, and here you are, you're my co-host. You should take over the show.
So everyone who's listening, you could be Michelle's co-host. You too, one day. Co-host Michelle Miao's program.
We spoke to Brody Levesque, who is a journalist and he's an author and he does his own show. He's with the New Civil Rights Movement. What I like about talking to Brody is he's got perspective as a gay man, as a journalist, and that, you know, obviously the media has changed, especially under President Trump's term as president and his administration. And so to hear from journalists who are doing the work and also expressing their frustration, like, this is very real and it's very validating.
Well, we also learned his deep, dark personal secret that he is, in fact, Canadian.
Let's get to the program. Welcome to the Michelle Miao Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. It's Thursday, so I'm here at the Commonwealth Club with my co-host, John Zipper. John, it's so nice to see you two times this week.
Twice this week. It's great to see you, Michelle.
We had a great talk with Katie Sowers on Tuesday, so we aired that on Progressive Voices Network, and it was a very wonderful talk. It was really nice to get to know her.
Yeah, I definitely urge anyone who hasn't heard it to go find it on both the Michelle Miao Show podcast, as well as we have it at the Commonwealth Club website. She is so clear-spoken, obviously, which I'm not right now, and really great at explaining her life. And what really blew me away was her talking about how she grew up in, you know, small-town Kansas, very religious family, went to a religious college, and it wasn't until at some point fairly well into college that she, for the first time, felt discriminated against because of her sexual orientation. And it's like, that is not what you would expect from a story from Kansas.
Right. And, you know, the big takeaway for me in getting to know Katie Sowers is that her presence, just her being hired, her being trusted by this team, that's going to open doors for not just, like, you know, the continuance or more hiring of LGBTQ people or women, but also the opportunity to change the culture of the NFL.
Yeah.
I mean, when you've got somebody in leadership and who's making calls, or, you know, the team's got to listen to and they've got to respect, I'm sure of it that just her being her authentic self, that that's going to add to the players and the culture, and hopefully, you know, by next year, 2 years, 5 years from now, a lot of things will change for not just the NFL, but I think for a lot of big organizations, companies in this country, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, today we do have a guest, and it's Brody Levesque, who is a journalist, an author, an award-winning one. I should say an award-winning journalist. He writes for the New Civil Rights Movement, and we'll check in with him about all things happening at the White House, the chaos, Russia, LGBTQ rights, and we'll just kind of get his thoughts on being a member of the media during, you know, this administration and what it's like to report. But first, I thought that it would be great to check in with you, John Zipper, the host of week-to-week political roundtable talk here on, not just on the Commonwealth Club website, but at the Commonwealth Club. You do an actual program. And let's talk. Let's check in. We haven't done that in a whole while, and you used to kind of start the show off with topics and news, but what's on your mind so much?
The whole world's fallen apart since we last talked. So actually, on Monday night, we had a week-to-week program, which will air tomorrow at this time on your show. And, of course, the first half hour of it was all about this incredible summit that Putin and Trump had. And just the Republicans and Democrats who were all saying, hey, look, A, this is bad. Quite a few of them on both sides saying this is treason. And this seems to be a really serious thing. I mean, it's every day since then where you kind of wake up, check the news, and it's like, what horrible thing has he either denied or done and then denied and then redone it? It's truly amazing.
I'm trying to make sense of it, and I'm going to come at you from, like, you know, an everyday person, and there's a part of me that this is going to sound really weird and really bad, especially for progressive voices and our listeners, but there's a part of me that wants to give him, you know, the benefit of the doubt, or give our president an opportunity to explain himself. And nothing right now makes any sense to me. It doesn't, not even from the perspective of, well, I just disagree with his position. Like, no. It just simply doesn't make any sense to me.
I used an example. A lot of our listeners might not remember this, or they might have been too young for it. But back in the 1980s, President Reagan held a big summit in Reykjavik with the Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev. And it was a summit where they went off to hold a meeting. And afterward, the White House really had to spin it. Because when word got out that Reagan and Gorbachev had discussed totally getting rid of nuclear weapons, obviously lots of people were just freaking out, Democrats and Republicans. They're like, is Reagan crazy? Is, you know, Margaret Thatcher, who had based her reelection campaign as British Prime Minister on retention of the nuclear umbrella, she was flipping out, and she called up George Shultz, Secretary of State and local San Franciscan right now, who she was saying, you know, this is terrible. You've got to, you know, get Ronald Reagan to basically go out there and disavow this. And he said, but Margaret, I agree with him. And what we've learned, in fact, from Jacob Weisberg, who's not a conservative journalist at all, who recently wrote a biography on Ronald Reagan, and he was saying, this actually was what Reagan believed. He was horrified by the idea of nuclear weapons and had been for decades. You know, he was willing to play tough and rattle sabers, but when he realized how close the U.S. and Russia, Soviet Union, excuse me, actually got to a nuclear war in, I think, 1983, it really impacted him. So, in other words, that summit was not Reagan going crazy and starting, you know, what we later learned was Alzheimer's. That was Reagan actually trying to pursue his dream.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can disagree or agree with him on all kinds of other things, but that surprisingly was actually what he wanted. Now we talk about this summit, and just like what you were saying, it's like, okay, trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. Did he actually know what he was doing? Was he kind of being crafty? I don't see that, especially because in his responses, it much more seems to be coming across of him not even knowing what they were talking about. Not being prepared for this. The Commonwealth Club's president and CEO, Dr. Gloria Duffy, she is a former Defense Department negotiator, actually. She got a lot of those former Soviet countries to give up their nuclear weapons during the first Clinton term. And when she was saying, look, when you have a summit like this, there's lots of preparation. You know, all these other departments are sending in memos, they're meeting, what are we going to do on this? You know, so that the president goes in there the most informed and ready, no surprises. You do not want a surprise at a summit with, you know, two of the most important people in the world. And that does not seem to be the case. And so now you have these really weird things where the Russians are coming out and saying, oh, the U.S. and Russia agreed to do XYZ. But there is no transcript of the meeting because Trump did not want any note takers there. Boy, does that not sound good. And Trump's own departments now, unlike departments going into a summit, they're supposed to be really informed. They're all like, what are we supposed to do? Wait, we're not prepared to do this. Wait, that might be illegal. Wait, we can't, what, you know, it is a disaster that seems to be, not because he was so crafty that he's smarter than the rest of us or had some ulterior motive, but he seems to have gone in there thinking, I'm the Mr. Negotiator, and I'm going to make things better with Russia. And my takeaway from the reaction from a lot of Republicans who have been critical of it, Republican leaders, is that they are realizing this is something very serious. Obviously it's serious, but I mean that this is not what we thought we were getting with Trump. We kind of thought he'd be acting up here or there, but we'd basically be able to contain it. And now they're realizing this is actually going right to the core of one of the Republican, you know, strong on defense sort of policies that have long, long lasting. So I don't have any news here that's going to make you feel more comfortable, because my take on it, and this is just me, but it's just me and everyone else who's writing about this right now, kind of, is that this really is disturbing. You really have a president who...
I think we just need to hear that, you know, not just from a Democrat versus Republican perspective or a Trump supporter versus non-Trump supporter, but that what's really going on here, and is this usual? Is it traditional? Is this out of left field? Does he really understand the relationship that the United States has with Russia, you know, historically speaking? But I think the biggest fear for me, or the thing that just signaled like, wow, what just really happened was the turning the blind eye from, you know, our own country, the FBI investigation in the Russian meddling of our election, and just kind of taking this president who's been known to not just the United States, but many other people around the world as a somewhat of a villain, if you will. But how do you take just their word for it at a press conference and be like, there you have it, guys. There's no Russian meddling. It was all a witch hunt. I mean, how did that just really happen? That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. I mean, and people have talked about how it's interesting now to see liberals and people on the left kind of saying, oh my God, we've got to defend the FBI and the CIA and all this kind of stuff, right? They were the ones who marched against the CIA and got them kicked off campus, et cetera. But they are realizing, wait a minute, of these two forces here, Trump buying into Putin's claims and agenda to some degree, or the people who have been investigating this, people like Robert Mueller, a Republican, who is just nose to the ground, facts, dealing really hardcore with what's going on, that people on the left and liberals are saying, it's actually Robert Mueller and the FBI and the CIA. We do kind of need to protect them, because we now see that this other guy is intent on disrupting anything that in any way threatens him. And if I might, I'm talking way too much, but if I might, there was a quote, David Frum, who came to the Commonwealth Club, I don't know, a few months ago. And he's, you know, former Bush speechwriter, definitely a conservative, still a conservative. I don't know if he considers himself a Republican, but he is a conservative, but he is a never Trumper. And he was asked when he came here, what do we get out of Trump? Are we really seeing this? He was saying, President Trump is so bad or inattentive and I don't recall if he said incompetent, but at all of those things that you want and expect a president to do, you know, all of his duties and things, but he's also very focused and very energetic on certain things that he's not supposed to be doing. And he said, Donald Trump has the most ferocious will to power of any president in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. That is what we're seeing, I think. That Donald Trump is willing to do anything to avoid this whole idea of him being an illegitimate president.
I want to turn our attention to this conversation about immigration in the country right now, because, it does impact and affect me personally, but at the same time, I think it's affecting a lot of people. There's so much that's going on, and it's not just like one group that we started out, you know, talking about when Donald Trump took his seat, or, you know, as president of the United States, with these executive orders that impacted immigration. But like, even taking, for example, the child, or, you know, children being separated from their families. Mm-hmm. You're looking at the chaos that's happening there. And then, you know, there's also the ban from the seven countries of travelers from those countries. And then there are immigrants who live in the country that are being impacted.
Mm-hmm.
The United States Immigration and Citizenship Department had just issued this policy change 3 days ago that kind of got my whole inner being all shooken up. And it was this very clear statement, very short, on their Twitter. It's so weird that we're, you know, people are making policy changes and just updating them on Twitter now. but clearly said that, you know, from now on, starting September 11th, the adjudicator has the full discretion to deny any applications without having to send a request for evidence or some kind of notice beforehand. So basically, if your application is incomplete or they find it to, for whatever reason, to have reasons for them to just completely deny it, they can. That's really scary to just put it out there and say that we have the full discretion and apply that to you know, Border Patrol people at the border, and then apply that to, you know, people who are checking visas, passports, or coming from these different countries. I'm thinking about the lives that we're impacting. What are we doing? What is this going to do to our country, you know, if we go another 2 years with Donald Trump, or possibly another 6 years?
Let me answer that in a weird way. There's a reason I'm doing this. So I recently, somewhat on a whim, ordered and started reading a collection of Buck Rogers, the original Buck Rogers comics. These were from the newspapers. So it's a collection of the first year. This is from 1929, 1930, I believe. And I've also read the original Buck Rogers book, not a novel, which is really two novelettes put together. They are so ferociously racist. The evil villains throughout the storyline are the Chinese. And at the end of the book, basically the last couple pages is talking about exterminating the Chinese. I mean, it's unbelievable. And of course, these came out in the 1920s when you still had bans on immigration of Chinese.
Right.
You know, that was normal. You know, people were not up in arms over Buck Rogers back then saying, how can you be so racist? That was normal. You know, America really has that in its DNA. We talk about it as being this welcoming country. Well, we're this welcoming country for people from my background, you know, Northern Europe. Everywhere else, we started getting really itchy and unhappy about people from South America and Southern Europe even, and, you know, Middle East and Africa, et cetera, and Asia. I think a lot of the urge that we're seeing in immigration these days is not just, oh, these people are worried about jobs. You know, this isn't all a sop to, you know, the workers in Ohio or whatever who you know, blame immigrants for, you know, mythically taking in jobs. It's a bit of a bit of wanting to go back to that setup where you know what your country is, it's more homogenous, it's us, and you don't have all of these other people coming in. I mean, it's a nativist thing. Really scary, and unfortunately, that's kind of where the momentum is around the world right now. So where will we be if, you know, this continues for another few years? The courts are going to be jammed again. I remember when they passed a rule change in, was it 99, 2000, or 98, something like that, that it used to be if you were an immigrant here, you were here, and you were out of status for any reason, they didn't renew your visa in time, whatever, you know, often for no fault of your own, you just had to fly back to your country of origin, stay there a day or two, and then come back and apply. I think you might have had to pay a $1,000 fine or whatever, something like that, or, you know, processing or something. Because it was a recognition that this is a really complicated system and it's not necessarily your fault. That was changed, and it was something like if you fell out of status for any reason whatsoever, and you left the country, you could not come back in for 10 years. You couldn't even apply to come back in for 10 years. And that's still in effect. Well, I talked to an immigration lawyer at one point, and he was saying how after this change came in, they had more cases then that went into the courts in like 6 months than they had had in like 10 years before. Because everyone then is taking these, you know, these harsh rulings, sometimes arbitrary rulings, and they're saying, "Oh, wait a minute, this is not the law." And then, and so it not only clogs up the immigration courts, you know, within the immigration system, but then when they go out of that, they go into the circuit courts, and it clogs those up. It's going to be a legal and expensive nightmare because, you know, some people can afford to hire those lawyers, others are at the mercy of, you know, maybe some, you know, public people who are doing this out of the, you know, pro bono help. But then others, just there's no way they can ever fight that. So, and that, I think, is the goal of the system. Make it more homogenous. Make these people, make the hurdle to get in here or to stay here so high that those people won't try to come to the border with their kids again. So that if you are denied, you just say, "I give up because I can't fight this."
Wow. I guess I should share then personally. I mean, those are all the feelings that my wife and I have. And reading that, you know, she got it from an immigration attorney in the United States who does a channel on Facebook all in Thai for Thai immigrants. Mm-hmm. So it freaked her out, and, you know, she just was like, "Let's just give up." Because it just seems like so hard, and it just seems like if the person, the adjudicator, you know, doesn't like us or the smallest things that they're questioning, they could say no. And if I'm reading it correctly, you're right. They could say no. I don't know what the process is after that, and I told her that. And she just said for her, you know, "I'm just thinking about, like, this big question, what is love worth? What is, you know, we obviously love each other so much that we're putting ourselves through this process, and it impacts both our lives, obviously hers being here in this country and wanting to be with me. At the same time, you know, what do you do when all of that then makes you become an invalid person and you're not trying to do the wrong thing? And it just hurts us for those reasons." And I just kind of I want to talk about this from a personal perspective because I want people to understand. Like, I think that when we talk about immigration and we focus so much on it just being a racial thing, that is what separates us and doesn't get to the core of this big conversation around reform. I understand that there should be process. There should be process. In my opinion, there should be a humane pathway for those who are families, for those seeking asylum, and for those, you know, who are dedicating their lives here to the United States and embracing our values, embracing our systems, truly want to be here. There should be a process to do that. But what I'm saying is the process makes it impossible. Today, the process makes it impossible. And under this current administration, it's becoming more and more and more impossible to the point where, I don't know, if I were the adjudicator and I was sitting there and, you know, and it was all up to me. My boss told me it's 100% up to you. What am I looking for? What am I looking for to say, "I validate you, and I think you should be here in this country"? So even from the social perspective, what is that going to do to humanity in the United States? What is that going to do about, you know, how we feel about ourselves and when we look back from now, and people's lives are going to be lost? We are already doing that with dividing or separating the children from their parents. We're already doing that with people who truly want to be together as husband and wife, wife and wife, husband and husband, and so on. So anyway, if you have thoughts around that and you're listening to Progressive Voices right now, and, you know, how do we figure out a way to have this conversation in which we can fight back and we can resist, but that there's an impact and that it's not that we're just butting heads with leaders of this country? What do we do? How do we get out of this? Because we have to. Because people are going to start dying, and so on.
I've been the voice of sadness and bad news so far in this program. So let me try to be actually a bit more positive. One thing that I've talked a lot about how. Look, the Democrats these days don't have power. They don't control the Supreme Court. They're going to control it even less in a year or so. They don't control the White House. They don't control either, House of the Congress. They don't control a lot of state governments. However, if you are in a state with a Democratic senator, if your U.S. representative is Democratic, they almost always have one or more staff people who focus on immigration issues. So you're rejected, say, you can go to them and see they can offer some help as well because they're getting tons of people coming to them. So any questions that, there are immigration lawyers who have their advice, I definitely talk to them. But also for navigating the federal system, Feinstein's office has someone who does that. Nancy Pelosi's office has someone who does that. Remember when Hillary Clinton was a senator, she had someone, definitely use that. There is help is what I'm saying. There is some hope and they can explain stuff to you, but they can also, depending on what the issue is, they can also go then to the immigration system and basically, kick some shins and get stuff to move faster.
Mm-hmm.
Second, do I have more good news? I don't know.
Come November, vote.
Well, definitely vote, but don't exhaust. I mean, if you're able to fight. If you can appeal something, appeal it. This is what I was going to say. Not so everyone who's sitting there who's a judge can make that, not a judge, but is in that position to administrate and decide you're validated, you're not. Don't assume that all of those people are, that they were all hired at the Charlottesville rally and, given a desk.
No.
Because a lot of those people are dedicated career people who've been there through multiple presidents, who probably, who knows how they voted.
Right.
And they take, so it's not that they're all going to be sitting there saying, I am going to make sure that no one who's not whiter than snow gets in.
Right.
A lot of them are, there's a good chance you're going to be fine.
Exactly. And I think my perspective is from, okay, well, a lot of people want a process. A lot of people are saying it's illegal when you cross the, state border line. And so that's what happens. And then your families do get separated when you go to jail. Like, those are the people I want to talk to. Like, this, how is that a process that is healthy, that is humane, and that is equal when it's discretionary? That's the point that I'm trying to make. But I know I could say that until I'm blue in the face to certain people and it wouldn't register. I'm being very serious. Let's talk about reform. Yeah. Let's talk about reform in which we're not looking at someone as if they're illegal before we legalize them. Thank you so much for touching base on the on Trump and the Russian investigation and Putin and that meeting. And then, of course, helping me process through the immigration stuff that's happening. There's a lot happening, and it's so easy to feel discouraged. But what I love about Progressive Voices and the Commonwealth Club is that we can have these open conversations. So if you'd like to join in on the conversation, hit us up at michellemeow.com. We're going to take a quick short break, but when we come back, we'll have Brody Levesque, who's with the New Civil Rights Movement, and we'll check in with him on all things politics and the media. Welcome back to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between show. I'm Michelle Meow, and John Zipper of the Commonwealth Club is here with us. And the second half of our program, we have a guest on the phone, and it's Brody Levesque with New Civil Rights Movement. Brody, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's always a great pleasure speaking with you, and I love your perspective. I follow you on Facebook, and I'm always wondering, how are journalists these days able to produce articles with just staying factual without injecting our own opinion? And sometimes your opinion – what happens when your opinion becomes fact? Like, for example, if you were to say so-and-so is a moron, and they truly are a moron – How do you do that without sounding like it was all, you know, just an opinion?
I make a distinction for myself, and I speak for myself personally, on my Facebook page and my Twitter feed, that those are my personal feeds, and that the viewpoints that I hold do not reflect those of either the new civil rights movement or any other publication or wire service that I may be, you know, gainfully employed by or freelancing for. However, when it comes down to factual presentations, sometimes that isn't really colorizing or editorializing so much as it's restating a fact that maybe someone else already has pointed out, as in the case of President Trump, when his former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson referred to him as an effing moron. And that was something that, you know, has been oft repeated privately by sources, even within the administration currently. It has been a long-held belief that, especially with the president, that things are extremely problematic, as evidenced by what we just witnessed with the Helsinki summit and the fallout after the summit with the White House running to do damage control and the president undercutting them again today. So it does become problematic. If you Google right now currently the word idiot, it's interesting because the web has managed to get all of the search engine crawlers to point towards images of President Trump. So if you Google idiot, you're going to end up with images of the president. I don't know if that is a collective hive mind doing that or what the case is. But when you talk about journalists, and I say that because I'm also a writing editor and boss, we try to stay away from that. You know, if you go by a pure textbook, you know, definition, is the president a moron? Quite frankly, the truth is yes, he is.
Well, I brought that up only really because it is an interesting time. It's an interesting time for the media and the way we're reporting on stuff, and it almost feels like chaos. You know, when it's hard to leave your opinion or your feelings out of what's happening. I opened up the show with John, and it was just kind of like everything that happened out of the Trump-Putin meeting made me feel a lot of stuff, and it was really hard to focus on what exactly was going on because there was some confusion around that. But really, we brought you on the show to, you know, kind of get your feelings and thoughts of, yes, everything that's going on with our president, the Russia investigation, how people are covering it, what angles you're looking for, and if that's stressing you out at all.
It's, you know, it's not stressing me out in terms of personally. It's stressing me out from the perspective of looking at the coverage as we're trying to cover it because there's so much information being thrust at us. You know, even on the overnight, we had a New York Times piece that touched off a firestorm last night that, you know, obviously someone was speaking to the Times and said point blank, the president knew before the inauguration that Russia had interfered. Well, that basically factually states that the man's been lying about knowing it since then. Then, of course, came the revelations to MSNBC earlier today that a lot of Trump Organization and Trump businesses had very deep ties to the Russian mob. Special Counsel Mueller has been running around getting indictments. They're getting ready to go to trial on the Manafort thing. We have another release we looked at this morning in the evidence, and lo and behold, 30 or 40 emails from Manafort to other people included, you know, Tad Devine, who was a strategist for Bernie Sanders. It really does play off of the fact that it is a tangled web, and it becomes increasingly difficult to follow the lines out of the web. And I tell my reporters, I say, look, what I need you to do is to nail down as many facts as you can. Don't speculate, and don't worry about if we miss something, because I'm sure it's going to come back and get us in the news cycle in the next, you know, 2 to 3 hours. And invariably it does. But I'll say this. There is a very, very clear and present danger to the democracy of the United States that I don't think a lot of people are really, truly grasping or understanding. I think they're rather blithely assuming that the Republic has survived worse. Well, the Republic has survived a lot of things, including a massive civil war, but everything that's happened to the United States up till now has always happened from within. It has never been propelled by someone sitting within your government and then turning around and basically working hand in hand with a foreign state that has, you know, definitely not the American nation's best interests at heart. What's shocking to me is that the Republican Party generally is avoiding that subject, and they are silent. You'll have a few lawmakers and a few people making noise. You know, and as my profession just keeps bringing it out, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, BuzzFeed, MSNBC, the Daily Beast. I mean, it's a pouring of information. At some point, I think people are going to have to ask, well, what's enough? I can tell you unequivocally, Michelle and John, based on what I've seen over the last particularly 14 months of the Trump administration and over the last easily 2 months of the Trump administration,
yeah,
that your nation's president is a liar, cannot be trusted, and senior members of his administration fall in line with that. That's an unhealthy thing to have sitting at the head of your government.
You know, I've got to ask, we're talking about Russia and Putin, and one of the more dangerous things to be over in Russia is an opposition or a non-government allied journalist. They have a habit of committing suicide by shooting themselves 37 times or whatever. Do you or your reporters get threats? And has that increased? Or do you feel more in danger now in a country where you're being labeled as the Lugan Press?
Yes. Absolutely. And even though the tragedy that took place in Annapolis at the Capital Gazette, and I knew one of them fairly well, he was a professor at the University of Maryland's Philip Merrill School of Journalism, was not directly related. There does become a license to kill. And this president, this administration, and this government has taken the same stance that, quite frankly, the government of the Russian Federation has taken. And that's dangerous for us. Yes, we have seen an increase in threats. And we have, quite frankly, seen a situation where I actually have reporters that are considering buying black jackets to cover certain events because of the level of hostility and outright violence that we've seen displayed.
Do you ever feel scared as a journalist? I mean, you know, for having it, or because of the facts is what I'm hearing, and kind of where our conversation is going, you have made the conclusion of how you feel about, you know, this president. Do you ever feel scared that, mm-hmm, you know, by voicing this openly, publicly, that you know, somebody could do something?
At worst, yes. At the least, you know, they could deport my Canadian butt, which would not be outside the realm of possibility with this administration. However, it really is honestly one of the things about doing the job. I mean, I don't savor this type of thing. I am certainly no let's just slap on the tights and the cape type of journalist. I don't look at it that way. It does concern me. I have family. I have friends. I have colleagues. It is extremely problematic. It's very disconcerting for us to be targeted in the United States of America by an American president and by an American government.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am. I was giving a pause. I'm still, after all this time, working out the bumps in radio, so I sometimes drive radio hosts nuts. Because I will stop talking because I assume there's a question and a follow-up.
Well, that's great, because I do have a question, but actually kind of switching topics a little bit, and that is Brett Kavanaugh and his nomination for the Supreme Court. Some folks have, you know, we've started to see now articles about, you know, well, what would he do for or against the LGBTQ community. Any thoughts, and if so, what are you and your staff following?
Kavanaugh, like Gorsuch before him, clerked for Kennedy. I think people tend to forget that Kennedy was a conservative and had a tendency, even though he came down more often than not as a swing vote on the high court, that isn't necessarily going to transfer over. There is some real problems with Kavanaugh, mostly associated with the time he spent in the second Bush administration, some of the opinions that he has written. Quite frankly, it's going to be extremely problematic. I can give you actually a contemporary, close to home for you and Michelle. As you know, the Ninth Circuit ruled yesterday against the Trump administration on the trans military service ban.
Yeah.
Should the administration go to run that up on an appeal, right now the court's not in session. So that means that the Supreme Court justice that rides over that circuit will have to make a decision whether or not to pass it on for conference, which means ultimately it could get scheduled and accepted. The writ would get accepted and would end up starting with the fall session or to deny it. Now, that particular justice happens to be Justice Kennedy. So if, let's say, Justice Kennedy decided to accept that, then it goes to the court. The court puts it on the calendar. Kennedy's now gone. Now you've got Kavanaugh sitting on the court because there's absolutely, I don't think, any way that the Democrats are going to be able to prevent him from being confirmed as an associate justice.
Yeah.
And he's sitting on the court. Now you've got Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, neither of whom, okay, are a big fan of the LGBTQI community. It could get a little dicey. As a matter of fact, it could get very dicey. So that's one area. Roe v. Wade, you know, that's another consideration. Yeah, a justice will say when they're sitting in the lower court, well, I uphold the tenets of this or I will abide by this, and whatever the case may be. That changes once they're on the high court because now they are at the point of decision. Once they're on the high court, that's it. On the lower courts, you know, the worst case scenario is the risk being overturned if you're a U.S. district judge by the Circuit Court of Appeals. And if you're on the Circuit Court, if it goes to SCOTUS and SCOTUS decides to take it and overrule you. But if you're sitting at SCOTUS and you are a Kavanaugh or a Gorsuch, then you have the ability, okay, to go past what your track record is. And let's face it, they can say whatever they want in their confirmation hearings. The real meat and potatoes of this is you look at the judicial record in Kavanaugh's case, both the judicial record as well as his record in the Bush administration, and that pretty well will accurately forecast what he will do once he's seated on the high court. Make no mistake, I seriously doubt that there's going to be any way to derail this nomination.
Yeah, I mean, if the president has his party in power in the Senate, I mean, confirmation hearings, what's the point? You know, he's gonna get this candidate. And if for some reason he didn't get this candidate, it's not like he's going to suddenly turn around and appoint a liberal. It's going to be another conservative. So I'm not sure what the Democrats hope to get out of this, except score some points with their base.
I mean, and I've maintained this, John, for a long time, that one of the things that has always been the biggest difference between the two spectrums politically in the United States is that you can get the entire right to have components of it that hate each other's guts. And I mean with vitriol and all sorts of nasty things. But they unify, they stay on message, regardless of whether they despise each other, and they get things done.
Yeah.
With the left, it's always trying to herd cats in a parade, which never works. The best example I can give you of that is your current situation right now in California. Okay, with Feinstein and Kevin DeYoung.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I mean, I look at that and I shake my head and I go, here we go again. That can be broadcast out as an example over the entire Democratic Party structure. To your point, sitting on the Senate, you're absolutely correct. I don't think there's anything that Schumer or that caucus will be able to do to block Kavanaugh's eventually becoming an associate justice of the Supreme Court. This will, unfortunately, tilt to court. And this is a type of tilt that stays in place 20, 30, 40 years, barring a miracle or the Chief Justice deciding that he's going to be the swing vote. And that's not likely.
Oh, wow. I'm just sitting here thinking about so many things I'm afraid of as a member of the LGBTQ community, as a female, as a person of color, an immigrant family. I mean, the list goes on. The more and more identities you tack on that that are impacted by this administration. What about for you, Brody, and maybe even John? I mean, Brody, for you, a member of the media, journalist, an LGBTQ person, a gay man. Also, what I'm hearing, I didn't know you were Canadian, so now I know that. What scares you the most? What keeps you up at night if you are awake?
I think the thing that concerns me the most is the propensity for an authoritarian regime like Trump's to create the fertile environment in the political petri dish for actual armed conflict and or civil unrest. Make no mistake about it. In a classic sense, this is, in fact, a regime. You have a unicameral right now. It's completely controlled by one party. You have a White House that is controlled by someone that, quite frankly, is extremely dangerous. He is definitely not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. And on top of that, you've got people even within his staff that are even worse zealots than he is, particularly on the issue of, I guess you could call it, nationalistic tendencies. You've got Stephen Miller sitting right there next to him, whispering in his ear. It gets very problematic with that. That's what concerns me, is that we may be looking at, you know, a conflict here, and it may not be a very pretty one. My thinking is, it probably won't be outside the borders of the United States. I think it's about to get ugly in your own borders.
When Charlie Sykes was here, you know, conservative, anti-Trumper, he was asked as his final question, you know, what are the chances of Donald Trump getting reelected? And he said, probably quite a bit better than you'd think. You know, he was basically saying, look, there are parts of the Democratic Party and the coalition that'll overreach and such. And Trump has a desire to remain in power and you know, continue his sense of legitimacy that's fiercely strong. What are your thoughts?
Will Trump get reelected? The bad part about this is that the conservatives actually pretty much spot on. There are some inherent problems with the Democratic Party, and there are even probably more so in looking at a unification problem. The Democrats have walked so far away from their traditional base, but walked so far away from, you know, the nuts and bolts. You have a population out there that doesn't feel they're being served well by them. And you have a president, nationalistic, authoritarian, however you want to paint him, that still, unfortunately, is garnering a tremendous amount of support. This thing with Russia could or could not be a blip on the radar screen. You know, the only thing that's going to stop this train wreck at this point, quite frankly, is going to be some sort of intercession. And that's either going to happen through, you know, the electoral process where, you know, in November you can flip the Congress, which we're looking at numbers and we're still not thinking that's going to happen, or that, you know, the Democrats are finally able to galvanize enough people in support to vote him out. But then the question becomes, you know, who do the Democrats really have that is going to attract enough of the independent and millennial voters to make the difference? When you consider that in 2016, the percentage of people that actually stayed home and did not vote, particularly in those three battleground states, which is what actually gave him the electoral vote and made him president of the United States, that is only too easy repeated unless people are so badly impacted by some of his policies. Now, that includes people within his own base. And I look at the tariff battle going on right now, particularly with China and now Europe, with Canada, with Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, how much abuse will the American voters put up with before they finally say it's enough? And that's really all of the key factors that play into it.
What's
people
the enough,
talk about
what is the enough
that's not going to happen.
But
go
I mean, like when we do, we end up saying enough. Is that the part where we, and I say we, when we all, you know, come together, when we say it's enough, is it, does that mean that we should impeach the president? Is that the point where we say impeach the president?
It should be enough, I think. You know, I really honestly, truly don't believe impeachment's going to happen. But I think that the best example I have seen of the most effective way of keeping Trump out of office in 2020 and finally taking back your government with some common sense, at least in the House, possibly the Senate, the best example I can think of are those kids from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, who have done an amazing and an incredible thing. If you look at the numbers, if you look at how proactive young people are now today, and that's a single issue, guns, but it has a carryover because the gun issue is also directly part of the overall and overarching scheme of problems, includes gay rights, women's rights, reproductive rights. That's all there. Those kids have been able to do an amazing thing. You've got to be able to galvanize enough people and enough voters, especially in disenfranchised communities, to do the exact same thing the Parkland kids are doing. And then you stand a chance of removing the unicameral problem. And once that's out of the way, you have a chance of getting things back. Enough in terms of impeachment, I'm sorry, is just not going to happen. You would have to have a complete, total flip of both houses in order to make that. And that's not going to happen. You're going to be lucky, okay, if you can get the Senate back, and the House is still problematic.
When you say the House is still problematic, I had been thinking the House was a good chance, not a sure thing, but a good chance for the Democrats to flip. But you're saying that's problematic, or that's even less likely than the Senate flipping?
It's problematic. The one thing that you factor into all of this is you have to take into account the gerrymandering of a lot of those seats, okay? This is your breakdown. In order to get the House back under Democratic control, you need 24 seats. In order to be able to pretty much override a presidential veto and keep the idiocy from the Republicans bleeding through, you'd need 34 to 44 seats. That's the number that you need. The sweet spot is 34 to 44. That's probably not going to happen because of gerrymandering. On the Senate side, you know, the Senate is so close now that there might be a way to take it back. Your best case scenario is they can flip it to a 1 or 2 point, a 1 or 2 seat, not point, you know, majority, at which time now you've got the ability to block Trump from any further judicial appointments, which is the worst case scenario, and also keep him out of mischief in foreign policy and some other issues. Mm-hmm. So the real hope here would be that the Democrats get the Senate back. I really don't think the House is going to happen.
Brody, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program and for sharing your thoughts with us and for continuing to do the work regardless of having the same fears that we all have. It's an interesting time for sure, but at the end of it all, just as John said earlier, there always has to be hope. And
I said that.
Yeah,
you say that at every program. There always has to be hope because there is a place for hope, and there are ways in which we could address some of the things that were being impacted. And it's going off the deep end and being in despair and doing nothing isn't going to achieve anything for us. And I think we're all being active, being proactive, and continuing to do the work, whether that's going to work or doing things outside of our own profession to do the right thing. You know, and I'm kind of being general about it because whatever you feel is the right thing, even speaking up or speaking out or sharing your opinion, I think is a big deal. We got to continue doing that and hopefully learn from one another and hopefully get through all these things that we've been talking about. But Brody, thanks again for joining us here on the program.
Not a problem. I really appreciate it. John, it's good to talk to you again. I'll leave you with this thought one last time. What you just said, Michelle, the torchbearer for that are the kids from Parkland and that generation. They're the hope. They're the ones that need to be supported, and they're the ones that are probably going to be able to make the change. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Brody.
Well, John, it's been a great program with you here at the Commonwealth Club. It was great to touch base mm-hmm. and not necessarily just focus, you know, on our subjects. You yourself, I mean, you do great work in not just representing as vice president of media here at Commonwealth Club, but also providing space for political conversations to happen in your week-to-week political roundtable talk. Sometimes people get caught up in thinking that they have to do something huge or measurable, tangible in order to be a part of the change. I think living your life and living it as authentically as possible, speaking up when you feel that it's wrong, and having respect for other people, doing just that. Remind yourself, you know, why you're doing it and why it's worth doing it. And I'm telling myself that in regards to even my own issues with immigration today, and that love is worth fighting for. But that I think humanity is worth fighting for. That's, I think, what I took out of today's program.
I agree. And I think you got some of this when we were talking with Katie Sowers on Tuesday, where she was kind of asked about some, you know, changes in policies and such, and she said, well, she sees her role and is doing her job and doing it well and being a part of this, and you know, like we were talking earlier, her being there is part of the change. I think everyone can realize they're part of the change. If they're not, someone else will take that opportunity to vote or to express themselves or to, you know, set the environment in a company office or something like that. And it's really important. And obviously what you do is, as I hope you really register. I mean, all the people who really do look to you, because you provide so many voices, an opportunity to be shared with other people. And I think a lot of people realize they're not the only ones because of you.
Well, thank you so much. So join us here on the Michelle Miao Show, especially Thursdays at the Commonwealth Club. You can head to commonwealthclub.org for programming information, registering to come. It's free for now, and then there are other programs that the club does that you should become a member. I would definitely advocate for you to become a member, and if you're in the Bay Area, these talks are so important. You can go to michellemiao.com for everything else that I do. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Miao Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
commonwealthclub.org/MMS.